Thank you. Marshall, if you can call court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, June 8th, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar today, two of which are set for oral argument. This is the first of them. This is A20-1443. Okonkwo versus State of Minnesota. Parties for each, or counsel, I should say, for each of the parties, you will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. All the rules that we have normally will apply, even though we are having the oral arguments via Zoom.gov. If there are any technical difficulties, and on occasion they do arise, we will make sure that we accommodate the parties if we have to pause the arguments and make sure everybody is properly connected. We have checked. It sounds like both parties are able to, are connected both orally and visually. So I think we're set there. This is being recorded. No other recordings are allowed unless permission is asked for beforehand, and to my understanding, no other requests have been made. So unless there are any other issues that I have not thought about that we need to address, we are ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record and the party that you are representing. You may proceed. And if you can unmute yourself.
Sorry,
there you go.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is P. Chinedu Waneri. I represent the appellant Semaje Okonkwo. Okay, sorry. Does Ms. Pippenhagen need to announce herself, or do I continue? Judge, you're on mute. Your Honor, you're
yep. Okay. Yep, you may proceed with your argument.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the main issues in this case are two. We submitted written arguments. I guess the court may have gone through all that. But in sum, the appellant didn't know about his rights till just about a few weeks to the deadline. And then before he could get himself together, the two-year deadline has passed. Now we have applied for post-conviction relief, and then that is where the second arm of this case kicks in. The district court, as expected, deny the relief, and it's not just peculiar to this district court. Most district courts in the state of Minnesota, they have found it extremely difficult to grant post-conviction relief that is filed after the two-year deadline because of the decision in Sanchez versus State. Now, if we go to Sanchez, you see Minnesota Supreme Court kind of lamenting that, well, in the absence of legislative direction, they have to do the best they can based on the letters of the law. I have cited, for example, the decision of the court in Olmsted County, Judge Chase. Judge Chase lamented in several cases, and incidentally, Judge Joseph Chase of Olmsted County District Court in Rochester. He has lamented severally, and he's just representative of what the district courts are facing. And he is kind of tear down the decision in Sanchez, saying that even if the reasoning in Sanchez should apply, then if the United States Supreme Court applied the same reasoning, what they ruled in Padilla's case, you know, would completely be different. So, but
Mr. Waneri, I want to ask you a question. I mean, I understand your argument about Sanchez, but as I see the district court's order denying post-conviction relief, the court not only talked about the petition being untimely, but addressed it on its merits, finding that there was no merit to your client's argument that his plea was not intelligent and that his lawyer was ineffective for failing to explain things to him. How do you respond to that aspect of the district court's order?
Your Honor, the client has exactly stated what happens, what happened, you know, during the proceedings. And he stated that he was a very young man at the time. And then he stated he did talk with his attorney. And his attorney told him, well, if you really want, your best bet is to take a plea. And if you really want this plea to go ahead, you have to answer questions this way. Because if you assert your innocence, no court is going to accept your plea. So that was simply, and he said it, that he was told to say what to say by his previous counsel. Now, after that, after the decision in the in Hastings, Polk County, when he went there, using another attorney on a similar case, he went to trial and he was acquitted. He came back to Dakota County again on a third case, different from this very first one. He went to trial under another attorney and he was acquitted. So even if you look at the state's case, all they are saying is, well, during trial, during the plea hearing, we asked you this, and you answered in the affirmative. And therefore, the door is shut on you. He said, okay, can I come in and testify and possibly lead witnesses? There was no merits hearing in the district court proceedings that led to this case.
But we had the same district court who accepted the pleas of guilty rule on the post-conviction motion. Isn't that judge in a position to evaluate credibility, having been in court and observed your client testifying and reviewing the plea petition with him? Why wasn't that an appropriate exercise of the district court's authority in the post-conviction context?
No, the issue of credibility in this case, doesn't really arise, because it's not like he testified to one thing, another witness testified to some other thing, and then judge was observing their demeanor and credibility. If you look at our brief, both the opening brief and the reply brief, the issues that we raised, that even the judge's own mandatory comments, the judge did not give, nobody challenged it that, this is not true. Even the state didn't challenge that. And the judge did not say that I observed you and then, you were credible or you are not credible. The transcripts are there. All the judge was saying is, I look at the cross-exam, we asked this question and this is what you answered. I looked at this other question, we asked this question, this was your answer. And so I think that, it was an intelligent brief. But the young man is saying, no, these three cases are related. This is what happened behind closed doors. I didn't know. This was what my attorney told me to say. That is not what really happened. And to my own benefit, in subsequent cases that went to trial on the same similar facts, the same parties almost, I was acquitted not once, but twice. Even back to your own county, it was tried recently. I was also acquitted. So all they are saying is exactly the same thing that he's complaining about, that my attorney did not inform me properly. And then even my statutory defenses, he asked me to even waive them, kind of. So he was right saying exactly, what happened. So the only thing that the court and this court is maybe faced with now is, well, this is what was answered in the records. This is what this young man is saying in his post-conviction relief. And all he's telling the court is, I was told what to say. But now, after this case, I've met other attorneys. in similar case who took me to trial and I was acquitted. I came back to Dakota County, another attorney, I was acquitted. And so, and when you now come in, okay, the judge now said, I'm looking at this, I won't let the door open for you to argue your post-conviction case on the merits. You know, I'll shut the door. And then he started applying Sanchez again, which will not allow them to come in. But the minutes of parliamentary discussions has shown that the intent of Congress, Minnesota Congress, on Sanchez was completely different from the ruling that the Supreme Court gave in Sanchez. But again, the Supreme Court did not have these transcripts at the time about the intent. And you see that the county attorneys were actually saying, we need to make a law, first of all, that will make Minnesota be like most other states that limited time for post-conviction relief.
But Mr. Wanneri, isn't that though for our Supreme Court to decide? I mean, we have to follow the law that our Supreme Court has made on that topic, don't we?
Your Honor, I'm not blaming anybody, not this court. This court followed the Supreme Court decision in Sanchez, you know, in the Lopez decision. I'm not blaming this court. I'm not even blaming the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court was kind of very vocal and said, we are limited because we don't really know the legislative, you know, intent, so to say. But in the absence of that, we have to look at the clear letter of the law and do the best interpretation we can. Now, stepping on that, that was why we now went to and dug in and got the legislative intent, the congressional minutes, so that the Supreme Court can say, oh, if this was what the congressmen, the senators, and Minnesota representatives were talking about, and then the witnesses were talking about before this case was decided, then it's time for us to have a review of our decision in Sanchez, because now we now have, you know, the opportunity to know exactly the congressional deliberations leading up to the amendment. And even if you look at the 590.01 statute, Supreme Court has again, even on its own, overruled or declared unconstitutional subdivision 4, as it relates to Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure. I think they cited it at the footnote there that, you know, if you look at the 5-9, I added it as one of our exhibits anyway. The footnote says, look, subdivision 4 has been overruled in Reynolds versus State by the Supreme Court, though on a particular, you know, narrow issue that one is not allowing effect to be given on a rule of criminal procedure. And they said, we are going to declare it unconstitutional. Now, you now see this subsection 4C is not also allowing the court to give effect on subsection 4B of the same 590.01. So at the minimum, it should be declared unconstitutional. Or in the bigger picture, the court can say, okay, now let's really look at our overall decision in Sanchez, because we now have more information. We now see where, you know, Mr. Congress was heading to and what the legislative intent was. And now we also have noted what the lower courts are screaming about, that this law doesn't help us the way it's been interpreted. So it's time for us to reconsider the decision in Sanchez. Now,
Mr. Wanneri, I just want to interrupt you real quick. I believe Judge Larkin had a question, and so I just want to make sure that.
Yes, no,
okay. I do have a comment, though, is you're putting a lot of stock in the argument that Sanchez should be reconsidered. And you, even in your reply brief, you note that we should review it and reverse it. But as Judge Berkman said, we have to follow the Supreme Court. We're the Court of Appeals. We're an error-correcting court, but only error-correcting for district court decisions, not Supreme Court decisions. So I wonder if you could talk more about the merits of the claim versus whether the statute is constitutional or not.
Pardon, Your Honor, the last sentence is...
Sure, if you could talk more about the merits of your argument versus whether or not Sanchez is, whether the statute is constitutional or not.
As the merits of my client's case?
Correct. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Your Honor, as I said earlier on, first of all, look at my client's age at the time he came to court. He was barely, above 18 years old, either 19 or 20. I don't think he was up to 20 at that time. He was naive, doesn't know much. It's his first exposure to the court system, virtually reliant on whatever his lawyer told him. And of course, take a plea, you won't go to jail, you will be fine. This is how you answer these questions. He went into court, did exactly as his attorney told him, and then he was convicted. Now, luckily for him, there was another case similar to this one that happened in Polk County. Different attorney, different scenario, different county. And they looked at it, asked him after interviewing him, he said, I didn't do this thing. They said, well, if that is what you're saying, let's go into court for trial. He went into court for trial. He was acquitted. A similar case arising from the same set of circumstances and actors came again back to Dakota County. Now he's older. He has this decision hanging over him. He has talked to several attorneys. His attorney in Dakota County now said, well, if you're maintaining your innocence, let's go in for trial. He went in for trial, he was acquitted. So all he's saying is, I had ineffective assistance of counsel to the extent that my attorney told me what to say, which is completely different from what happened, in this case. And I didn't know anything. I didn't even know about post-conviction relief. Now, I'm slightly older. I'm exposed to the legal system. I have talked to several attorneys, and this is what happened. After that case, I could have continued maintaining be on the same trajectory of saying I am guilty. But he said, no, this is not what happened.
Okay. And then counsel, your time has expired, but I did see that Judge Larkin had her hand raised. Okay, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for the state, you have 15 minutes for your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Your Honors and co-counsel. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney in Hastings, and I'm here on behalf of the state to respond in this matter. Simply put, Your Honors, the district court in this case did not abuse its discretion when it summarily denied the petition for post-conviction relief, the untimely petition for post-conviction relief that was filed in this matter. Your Honors, this petition for post-conviction relief was filed almost 3 years after the defendant was sentenced on these cases. I understand that appellant claims that, interestingly, he learned about post-conviction relief just before the 2 years expired. He still waited almost a year to file his petition for post-conviction relief. So there is no interest of justice exception that has been established here to that two-year statute of limitation that is established by the statute. Clearly, ignorance of the post-conviction statute of limitation. The case law has established clearly that is not an excuse, that does not result in equitable tolling, and that certainly does not rise to the level of interest of justice in this case to decide on the petition. And I know that the court has noted that the court did address the merits of the petition in addition to finding it untimely, and I'll address that also. But they did not need to do that because the petition was clearly untimely. On the timeliness issue, the appellant relies exclusively on the interest of justice exception, in this case, the 4B5 exception. But unfortunately, the appellant in this case is making essentially the same mistake of law that the appellant made in the Sanchez case, and that is confusing the merits of the petition with the basis of the interest of justice claim. And the interest of justice exception, Sanchez made very clear, goes to why did the appellant miss the two-year deadline, not to the merits of his underlying claim. And in this case, the only explanation for missing that two-year deadline was simply, well, I didn't know about it. And then I still waited another year to file a petition. So there really isn't anything that establishes that interest of justice exception. In addition to that, even—
Should it make, does it make a difference, Ms. Piepenhagen, that sort of the interest of justice and the underlying assertion, I mean, it all has to do with ineffective assistance of counsel. Doesn't that make a difference in terms of the analysis of what the interests of justice are?
I don't believe it does. I mean, Sanchez was an ineffective assistance of counsel case also. And they analyzed it in the same way. And as he's belabored throughout this argument, he had other counsel in other matters that were pending that entire time that this case was tolling, that the 2 years was tolling. So I don't believe so. But the other issue with the interest of justice, even if he has established there is a valid reason why he missed the 2 year statute of limitations, the other half of that exception is, and the claim must not be frivolous.
And Ms. Piepenhagen, could you address that? Could you address the merits of his claim, his argument that he received ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes. And the district court did also address the merits of the claim in addition to finding it untimely. And the district court correctly analyzed the merits of his claim. And they are indeed frivolous. So that doesn't satisfy the second part of the interest of justice exception. But they essentially fall into three categories. I think the first two are very easily dismissed, that the plea did not comply with the rules of 15.01. And I think the only error alleged there is that the court did not ask if he was making any claim of innocence. In this case, clearly, both his counsel and the prosecutor, I believe, addressed that issue. And the court was presiding over that hearing, heard that answer. And the case law also is clear that things like that, slight variances in the 1501 do not invalidate a plea. So the claim that it didn't follow the procedures of 15.01, we submit as a frivolous claim. The other, the second one was that his attorney didn't advise him of collateral consequences. As clearly noted by the district court, there's no obligation of his attorney to advise him of the type of collateral consequences that he is referring to in this brief. And then the third claim, and I think it's the one that he relies the most heavily on, is a claim, kind of a confusing claim. I think that his attorney either didn't advise him of the mistake of age defense or else advised him about it, but told him to lie during his plea. And I'm not even clear. I think you have to rely on his affidavit. At what point in the brief, I think he says he wasn't advised of the mistake of age defense. Clearly he was, because it's discussed during the plea. In his post-conviction affidavit, he then contradicts that and says he did discuss the mistake of age defense with his attorney. So he clearly was aware of it, but his attorney told him to say that he knew the victim was of a certain age and waive that defense during the plea hearing. So in his affidavit, he's indicating that he knew of the defense, but made a conscious decision to waive it and to plead guilty after being advised by his attorney that this was the best route to take.
Doesn't he say, though, in his affidavit that, yes, we had a brief discussion, but isn't the gist of it that his lawyer didn't explain in detail what the mistake of age affirmative defense really meant and how it might apply to him? And don't we have to accept that as true for purposes of ruling on in this appeal?
He does say in the affidavit that he didn't explain it to him in detail. But during the plea hearing, when the affirmative defenses were addressed, he was asked if his attorney advised him of the mistake of age defense. He said yes. When asked multiple times during the hearing, do you have any other questions? Is this how you want to go forward? He indicated yes. So I don't want to go back and apply the integrity of proceedings analysis that underlies the interest of justice exception to the merits, because Sanchez clearly said we don't do that. But I will say that the fastest way to ensure no integrity in any criminal plea proceedings is to say that we're going to set aside what the defendant says during the plea. Even though we spend all this time going through plea petitions, even though we've made it clear we need to spend all this time on the record talking about waiver of rights, have them address every specific right on the record, they can come back 3 years later and say, I didn't mean what I said. And that really would be the epitome of no integrity in the plea proceedings. And that is not what the interest of justice exception is there for. It really would make all of the waivers in 1501 meaningless if the defendant could do that. So I think the district court correctly analyzed the issues and found no merits, certainly no error there and no abuse of discretion. And again, didn't even have to address the merits because there really has been no interest of justice reason to set aside the untimeliness of this post-conviction petition. And just briefly, as far as if there's any question what the interests of justice are that are being alleged as an excuse for missing the deadline, you know, one is I didn't know about it. I've already addressed that. I just want to briefly address one other thing because it's been talked about so much by appellant today, and that is these two other cases in which he was acquitted. And this was, they are both after the fact, and as indicated by appellant's counsel today, completely different scenarios, completely different cases where he was acquitted. To any extent that would be considered an interest of justice to reopen this plea 3 years later, I think it's clear that is not a reason to undo the plea in this case. And then just finally on timeliness, I did have the chance yesterday to review some additional filings. And I think I did managed to get out a motion to strike those yesterday afternoon, but because they were addressed during appellant's oral argument, I just want to bring up that I believe at the end of the day on Friday, he supplemented his briefs with some additional filings. Talked about them today in argument. There certainly is no basis in the rules for appellant to submit additional supplements to his briefs other than a new supplemental authority, which 128.05 clearly allows. If a new case is decided, you can submit that. That is not what was submitted here. What was submitted here are old materials that he simply did not include in his brief. So I filed a motion to strike those, and I would submit that those should not be considered by the court in this case. And therefore, unless the constitutional claims, again, also addressed by Sanchez, and I think, as already noted by this panel, you are an error-correcting court. I think appellant essentially disagrees with the Sanchez decision, and that is for the Supreme Court to address. I would also note, since a lot of the legislative intent was discussed in appellant's argument, the legislature's had all kinds of time since the Sanchez decision came out to address that legislatively, and they have not. And the Supreme Court has not overruled Sanchez either. So that is the law, that's the statutory law, that is the case law, and that is what this court should follow. And unless there's any other questions, then I would forfeit the remainder of my time.
Any other questions from the panel members? Looks like none. Thank you very much, Ms. Pippenhagen. Back to you, Mr. Muneri.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, my learned friend, Ms. Pippenhagen, talked about Service of Criminal Procedure 15.01, I think subdivision one. 15.01 subdivision one, statutory laid down mandatory warnings that not counsel, but the district court judge, presiding district court judge, must give to a defendant taking a plea. That provision was not complied with. We laid it out down in our motion for post-conviction relief. The district court, in all the decision of the district court denying relief, did not deny that the court did not comply with the provisions of Rule 15.01 Subdivision 1. Now, compare it with one of the cases that we referred to and annexed in our addendum supplement, which was the Sahal Shidane case that arose, came up in Rochester. And before the same judge Chase, the issue was raised that the mandatory warnings were not given. The court was bold enough to say, yes, we omitted to give those warnings, but however, we are handicapped by Sanchez. We cannot give any relief. We can't grant relief. If you come back to this present case, the court never denied or asserted affirmatively that I did comply with 15.01 subdivision one of the rules of criminal procedure. So instead, the court doesn't deny that. It doesn't say anything about it. And the state, in their brief, did not deny that the provisions of 15.01 subdivision one we are not complied with. So that is one layer there. In addition to the ineffective assistance of counsel, now the state is saying that, oh, it takes 3 years. But if you go to legislative intent, what they were saying is we allow 2 years, and after 2 years, if an exception kicks in, we allow another 2 years from the time the respondent applied for post-conviction relief. So technically, people like my client, if 4C is construed properly, 4C will give 2 years from the time of discovery of their rise to post-conviction relief. After that time, they are shut out permanently forever. So what Ms. Pippenhagen is saying now is, oh, it's now 3 years, without giving effect to how 4C, if it were properly analyzed and construed in Sanchez, how it would have been applied. If it's applied that way, my client's case, is timely. Now, they talked about—
Mr. Guarneri, the exception, I think you raise a good point. We're talking about the exception, and the exception to the 2-year bar of untimeliness can only be invoked if there is an explanation as to what caused the petitioner to miss the deadline, not the substance of it. And in this case, I think the 3-year calculation is being made at the time of the plea, where he acknowledged that he did have the opportunity to discuss with his attorney a mistake of age defense. It's my understanding that's what he's relying on for that. Why shouldn't that be calculated from the time that he acknowledged in open court that he was aware of the mistake of age defense 3 years before he filed his post-conviction petition?
Your Honor, he was not pro se. He was represented by counsel. I actually did exactly what his counsel told him to do. Now, the state stated that he has had other counsel. Those other counsel concentrated on their case, whether they were careful not to maybe malign another counsel or not, is a different ball game. But they said, as far as what you are telling us, and as far as you're not accepting responsibility, we're not going to ask you to go and take a plea, but we are going to have you to stand trial. So that is it. But the reasoning that you gave is exactly the same reasoning which the Supreme Court gave in Sanchez, that keeps giving this absurd result that everybody is screaming about. I understand that the Court of Appeals must follow precedent from Supreme Court, but in our rules, the way the court hierarchy is, we still have to pass through the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals might make a recommendation to Supreme Court based on what we are seeing. Please consider, you know, doing this, or even might be proactive and, you know, rule based on the merits of the case. Now, their motion to strike, they're asking this court to strike a RCAP 128.05 letter. That does not suffice. We didn't write any memorandum. We didn't submit anything.
Yeah, and counsel, we certainly understand your argument there, and okay, we will review the submissions that have been sent in yesterday and today on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Unless there are any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you both for the oral argument and your briefing. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an order on this case within the statutory timeframe. Thank you both.
Thank you.